is Andrew. Welcome to Keen on America. On July 4th, 2026, America will be 250 years old. An anniversary that will, no doubt, be greeted with a mixture of celebration, contemplation, and resignation. In Keen on America, we talk to prominent US citizens, not just about their country's past and present, but also about its future. What, I ask my American guests, will be the 21st century fate of their now venerable republic? Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Keen on America. Today we have an intriguing guest. Samuel Lane is many things, an athlete, an entrepreneur, an author, a philanthropist, an attorney, an educator, an investor. He's American and he's also Haitian. He's quite a remarkable fellow. He's not that old, but he's done a lot in his life. Samuel, welcome to Keen on America. Tell me when and where you were born.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. Great to meet you and speak with everyone. But so born in 1984 in New York, in upstate New York, in Rockland County, actually. So just maybe 20, 30 miles north of New York City.
And tell me about your parents.
Yeah, so both my parents actually emigrated to the U.S. From Haiti, as you mentioned, in the 70s. And so my mother came a little bit earlier than my father, but then was raised in Rockland County in Spring Valley, which is close to the Hudson River. My dad's family actually ended up in Montreal, even though he ended up here in the U.S., but they met here in the States, and then the rest is history, as they say.
Wow, history is a complicated thing, Sammy. You don't need me to tell you that. How did they encourage you to think of yourself? Were you encouraged to think of yourself as a Haitian immigrant or as an American or as both?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, as an American, for sure, I think that's how my parents encouraged myself. And I've got two younger brothers, encouraged us to think of ourselves. But then beyond that, in terms of forming my own identity, my own thoughts of myself, I eventually thought of myself as very, very certainly Haitian American, right? Because we observed a lot of Haitian traditions. I had a lot of friends and family who happened to be Haitian. A lot of the food and religious and all of that was still very Haitian in its roots. But of course, having been born here, availing ourselves to all of the benefits of being an American and growing up here in the States, we also had that side of it as well. But no, we were American through and through. And then, you know, as I understood and had more of a concept of who I was and what our family represented, then I was able to pull in a lot more of the Haitian ties. But both, you know, my brothers, my parents speak Creole. My grandmother speaks Creole. I had my great grandmother, you know, had her alive for a lot of my life. She only spoke Creole, which that along with French is the national language of Haiti. So, no, we were very proud to be American, but then also ultimately very proud to be Haitian American.
Were you made to feel at home in America, you and your family?
That's a great question. For the most part. For the most part, I think as with any family that's immigrated here to the States from anywhere else, and then you couple that with being African American, being Black in the United States as well, you've got a lot of tensions here and there. And so there were times, especially, you know, you once in a blue moon would run into someone who was a little bit more ignorant than you're used to dealing with. And so you'll get the go home or go back where you came from, or if you don't like, and then all of that. But thankfully that was actually a rarity. And so, yeah, no, I think, you know, where we were, and also we did have, as I mentioned, a very tight-knit family and also a very solid Haitian community in Spring Valley and Rockland, New York as well. As a support system. But no, I think we were, I can't say that we weren't made to feel not well, that we were made to feel not welcome. So yeah, absolutely.
You talked about more ignorant people treating you badly, suggesting that you're not welcome or perhaps not even American. What about the law? Did you, as you were growing up, did your father have the kind of conversation which Black fathers or Black mothers often have with Black sons about the police and the nature of the American judicial system?
Yeah, you know what? Not explicitly. Not explicitly. I think a lot of that came through just my understanding, like him and my parents educating me about the history of the US and civil rights in the US and so on and so forth. But no, I think those conversations that parents have with Black children and Black boys in particular, I think they weren't as prevalent, at least for me then, as they are now. And so no, and again, I think a lot of it came the my understanding of how to deal with police in those situations, and in general, just what it meant to be Black in the United States, what it meant to be Haitian American in the United States. A lot of that came through more implied learning and understanding than an explicit sit down conversation, and make sure if you get pulled over, have your hands in this position, and so on and so forth.
You came late, so to speak, as a Haitian American to America. America's already had 300, 400 years of racial history, much of it profoundly unjust. How do you fit yourself in, and your family fit
Yeah.
you and your brothers and your parents and your own kids into the narrative of African Americans in North America? Do you see yourself as intimate with that history or somehow separate?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Not at all separate, right? Because I think at the end of the day, even though we might be Haitian American or Caribbean American or right, and still in the United States, you're still an African American, you're still a Black man or Black woman or Black child. And so, even though, of course, Haiti's history is different, being here, having been born here, being raised here, raising my own family here, our connection to the history of the United States and African Americans in general is very, very near and dear and close. So I wouldn't say it's at all separate. And then also, some of the same struggles that others have here that I think people who aren't of Caribbean descent or who haven't emigrated from other African nations, once you get here, those struggles are the same. And you're kind of, for better or worse, lumped in all together. You're dealing with the same socioeconomic difficulties. You're dealing with the same implicit biases. You're dealing with the same systems, quote unquote, that are typically unjust and have been unjust for hundreds of years.
Given that Haiti, of course, had its own complicated and tragic history of slavery and violence, is that in some way similar to the history of slavery, particularly in the American South and the Civil War, or do you see it as different?
Yeah, I mean it's different. It was similar to a point, and then in 1804, Haiti was able to fight for its own independence, and you had the Haitian Revolution, and of course the slave rebellion there that ended up Toussaint Louverture and Dessalines, like they actually won that revolution, right? So up to a point it was identical, and then Haiti became an independent nation some time ago in 1804, and so I think. Now that ended up being a catalyst for other issues that have now plagued Haiti to this day, and I think that's a whole different question. But no, I think the question of was this the story of slavery in Haiti is similar to what it was here in the U.S. It was up until Haiti fought for its independence and won it, and of course ended up being the first free Black republic. And so I think that's a point of differentiation. And then of course here you had eventually the Emancipation Proclamation and Civil War and all of those things that ended up meaning that slaves here in the US could have their own freedom as well.
How did you learn Haitian history? Was it something that your parents educated you about? I'm guessing you didn't learn much about it at high school.
Yeah, no. I didn't learn much about it in high school. My parents didn't, I think a lot of it I sought out myself, to be honest. And to some extent, to be honest, there are some places where the Haitian Revolution is just a footnote, but even as a footnote, I at least was able to glean that information. And then a lot of it I had to seek out myself, right? And understand just the revolution and freedom and the tariffs and a lot of the money that Haiti had to pay back to France and even the US in some regards. And then you've got the history of dictatorships and so on and so forth. And then there came a time, to be honest, where in the early 90s, a lot of what was going on in Haiti, and even now until to this day, a lot of what was going on in Haiti was being televised here. None of it positive, unfortunately. But even in that time, again, I was starting to form my own awareness as Haitian American, and then started to do my own research into the history of Haiti as well.
Samir, there's a concept, you're all too familiar with it, probably not just in theory, but in practice, of the American dream. And in some ways, perhaps some people might think that you represent that American dream. You came as your parents came as Haitian immigrants to the United States. They had three boys. You were the oldest. You ended up at Harvard. In fact, your roommate was a certain Mark Zuckerberg, who doesn't need much of an introduction. Do you see yourself as a vehicle, a model, an example in a positive way of what's called this American dream?
I mean, probably to some extent, right? I mean, for folks who come here from another nation, who come here for better opportunities, and a lot of times those opportunities are for their children, and they're looking to live out their dreams through their children and ensure that their children have more opportunities than they could have had from wherever they came from. I'd say, yeah, almost certainly, right? And you know, I heard a previous guest of yours, maybe within the last week or so, mentioned that the American dream has different tenets, right? It's opportunity for your children that you didn't have, and it's being able to age gracefully and be in good health and all of those things, right? And so I think to some extent, if you're coming from another country and you're coming here, and you're like myself, my two younger brothers, you're able to have more opportunities, you're able to excel, you're able to avail yourself to things that my parents could never even imagine having in Haiti. And so for my parents, almost certainly, me, my brothers, we represent to some extent, the accomplishment of the American dream and the being able to attain it, the attainment of the American dream. I think my parents would almost certainly agree with that. But now for different generations, it probably means different things. And even for individuals from my parents' generation who didn't emigrate here from somewhere else, their concept of the American dream might be different. But yeah, I firmly believe that a key piece of it is opportunities and a life for your children that you couldn't have or didn't have, creating opportunities for your kids. And my parents did that, right? They poured into us. They helped us understand what it meant to succeed and how to excel and how to do that. And they helped steer us in the right direction so that a lot of the opportunities I had, whether athletically or the ability to go to Harvard, that came from my parents helping to steer me, helping to understand that knowledge is power and the value of education, all of that stuff. But I think a lot of that came from their looking to achieve the American dream. And a part of that is why they came here, why their parents came here, and so on and so forth. So yeah, I do think that, again, myself and my brothers almost certainly represent that for my parents.
Do you think your example for or against this raging debate in the US about affirmative action?
It's a good question. I'm not sure. I think that there's a lot of misinformation on both sides of the equation, right? And so to some extent, I think that there's this misconception that affirmative action means people who shouldn't be getting opportunities or getting opportunities just based on their race. And to be clear, again, part of the misinformation is that affirmative action is solely focused on race, right? It's focused on diversity of many, many, many different kinds, gender and neurodiversity nowadays, and class diversity, right? Some of affirmative action means you're, so it's not just race-based, but I do think the biggest misconception that I've seen is that affirmative action means people get opportunities that don't really deserve them. And then now it's become this thing that, in particular, African Americans are getting opportunities and keeping other qualified students of other races from getting, and so on and so forth. And so, I don't know. I think in my case, I understood that as I applied to any university, that I was just as qualified as anyone else. But yeah, depending on the question of, would I be an example for or against him? I'm not sure. It depends on how you view the question of affirmative action, to be honest. It depends on whether or not you're for it or against it to begin with, and how you understand affirmative action. Because like I said, a lot of people who are misinformed think that affirmative action just means that Black people get opportunities that they don't deserve in jobs and in universities, which couldn't be further from the truth. But at the same time, I think on the other side of the equation, the concept of why affirmative action is important is being oversimplified as well. But at the end of the day, I think there's no denying the fact that for hundreds of years and you know, several hundred years, as you mentioned, people haven't gotten opportunities that they have deserved. They've been kept from institutions and kept from opportunities, and whether it's university or jobs or the ability to buy a home and all of those things, right? And so to some extent, being able to, I wouldn't even say level the playing field, but being able to give overlooked and underrepresented individuals opportunities that they wouldn't get otherwise, A, doesn't mean that they're not qualified for those opportunities. It just typically means that they're not looked at for those opportunities. And B, can go a long way to generating future wealth and in equalizing what that individual's future might look like and their kids' futures looks like, and so on and so forth.
Samir, so you worked very hard, you performed hard, you got into Harvard. What was your experience there like? You roomed with Zuckerberg the first year.
Yeah.
As you suggest, affirmative action is complicated. I don't know what percentage of legacy students there are at Harvard, but it's a significant amount. You got into this citadel of the American ruling class, which I'm guessing you hadn't had much experience of before. What was it like there? What do you remember?
Yeah. And to your point, I mean, I applied at a bunch of elite institutions and got into just about all of them, right? And so, and I chose to go to Harvard because I went there. It's funny, I applied to Yale and Dartmouth, Georgetown, Northwestern, and got into all of those places and chose to go to Harvard because when I went for my admitted students weekend there, it felt the most comfortable, in spite of being this citadel of to some extent, as some people believe, citadel of education, but also elitism and so on. But I always give people the answer that, I get this question all the time. What was it like, and how did you feel, and was it? I had a ton of fun. It was fun. To me, it was my only experience of college, and it's what I know college to be. And so it doesn't mean maybe we didn't party as much as other students at other schools, but we partied a good bit. And so I had a great time, made tremendous friends, made lifelong friends. And so like my concept of what college is supposed to be was that, right? You go there, you have fun, you make great friends, you work hard as well. Of course, I was a student athlete, so I was balancing that at the same time. But it was, you know, to some extent, I went in and I didn't, I got a bit of a culture shock because Cambridge and Harvard is not like Newberg or Newberg Free Academy, the school where I came from. But I wouldn't say that, you know, I had my life turned upside down, or because, you know, I got there and got a bunch of other 17, 18, in some cases 19 year olds who are leaving home for the first time, and they're having a good time. You know, so I went there, I worked hard, made great friends, had a great, great, great time. And so, yeah, it's tough for me to say that my experience was that different than what a quote unquote quintessential college experience would be.
You note that you're an athlete, very successful athlete. In fact, you went to the Olympics, but you wore the jersey, not of the US, but of Haiti. How did that come about?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, for me, my first time competing internationally was in 2007. I graduated from Harvard. I went down to the University of Texas. I got a master's degree there. And I also had an extra season of athletic eligibility because I was injured for my senior year at Harvard. And then after finishing my master's degree at Texas, I ended up going to the Pan American Games in Haiti. In Rio de Janeiro, but representing Haiti for the first time. And so for me, I made the choice, A, to represent Haiti, because what I saw on the international stage was that, and this really became crystallized for me at the Olympics in 2012, but was that Haiti didn't have many representations of athletes on an international stage wearing the jersey and representing the country and also competing at a very high level, right? And so in the US, we've got a ton of athletes, we've got a lot of NFL players, but also NBA players and other athletes as well. But internationally, whether it's soccer or track and field or swimming, whatever those international sports, you didn't see it much. And so I wanted to at least go out there and represent the country of my parents' birth, but also represent the country that I knew needed that sort of representation. And it also meant that I could have competed for the U.S. as well. I think my freshman year of college, I went to U.S. Junior Nationals and then switched to represent Haiti several years after that. But it was a conscious decision. And so it also meant that I was able to give Haiti a face on that international athletic stage that it didn't typically have. And not to say that it never had it, right? Because prior to myself, we had a hurdler, Dudley Dorval, at the 2000 games. He was in the finals for the hurdles. He was a world-class hurdler, but I think Olympians and international athletes in the U.S. are a dime a dozen. And in Haiti, it's far, far from that. And, you know, that was even more evident in 2012, as I mentioned, where the U.S. team had almost 600 athletes and the Haitian team had 5 in London at the Olympics. And so, it meant that everything I did wearing that jersey was that much more impactful.
So just remind everyone what happened at the 2012 Olympics when you were wearing the Haitian jersey, one of the 5 members of the Haitian team. How did you do? What were you competing in?
Yeah, I did the triple jump. Ended up being my premier event. I did multiple events in college, long jump a little bit and sprinted here and there. But triple jump was my bread and butter. At the games in 2012, I finished 10th. In the finals. So typically,
which is pretty good. I mean, that's impressive. Were you pleased or disappointed?
No, I was disappointed. I was disappointed, but I was disappointed because going into it, I knew I had the ability, if I performed at my best, could be at potentially on the podium, at the very least top 5. Also, you know, I wanted to win Haiti's first Olympic medal since 1926. And it just so happened that it was a long jumper who won that medal. And so to be a triple jumper, the kind of sister events, my goal was to go there and win Haiti's first medal in many, many, many decades. And so finishing 10th at the Olympic Games is never a bad thing. And then, you know, you've got a 2-day competition. You compete on one day, you qualify for the finals, and then 2 days later you compete in the final. So just being able to get past that first day and be in the finals is an accomplishment in and of itself. But of course, being a competitor and going there and trying to perform at your best. And I wanted to have my personal best lifetime performance on that stage and wasn't able to do it. But no, not now, of course, looking back at it, you think you're an Olympian, you went to the Olympics, you made it to the finals, you finished 10th. And then of course, after qualifying for the finals, the president of Haiti at that time, who was Michel Martelly, gave me a call, congratulated me, let me know everyone was watching, was proud of me, and so on and so forth. And so that meant a lot as well. It also, I think, reaffirmed my notion that going to the Olympics for Haiti was impactful, making it to the finals, finishing 10th was impactful. My understanding is that they had, you know, several thousand people watching the finals and the games while I was competing, which, you know, as a U.S. Olympian, you make the finals, kind of like, that's what you're supposed to do. And the president's not going to call you for making the finals, right? But I think that meant a lot. It was a couple of years, of course, after the earthquake, the big earthquake that had taken place down there. But yeah, I finished 10th. And now that we're 12 years on, I can look back and say it's not so bad. But in the moment, was very different, very disappointing.
Yeah, I'll take it. 10th in the Olympics. One final question before we get to the break, Samir. I'm guessing your participation was a huge deal in Haiti, and particularly your success. What about in the U.S.? Did you get any coverage? Did anyone question you competing for Haiti, given that you were born in the U.S. and you went to college in the U.S.?
No, not at all. Not at all. So I got a lot of coverage. Part of it, a good bit of it, being tied to my relationship with Mark and us having been roommates and so forth. But even so, I had a lot of people who were just interested because, you know, 2009 and also leading up to the Olympics, I was top 10 in the world, right? Which is a rarity to some extent for a Haitian athlete. And so I think I had the seventh farthest triple jump in the world in 2009 and was around that top 10 leading up to the game. So I was able to garner my own attention going up to the games myself as well. But no one asked the question or no one actually frowned upon it, is what I should say. People did ask the question. And of course, me simply saying, like, look, we got 500 U.S. Olympians here. We got 5 Haitian Olympians. It's kind of clear. And I think people understood that. But also honoring my parents and my Haitian heritage, people, no one took issue with it at all. Wall Street Journal called and New York Daily. We got a whole bunch of press, which is a lot of fun. put a lot of positive spotlight on Haiti at that time. A lot of people did ask about Mark, but no one really asked in a critical way about my choosing Haiti over the U.S.
We're speaking on Keen on America with Samir Lane, who is many things: athlete, entrepreneur, author, philanthropist, attorney, educator, investor. In the first part of this conversation, we've mostly talked about him as an athlete. Going to take a short break, and then I want to talk about his career in innovation, in philanthropy, and in investing. I want to thank our friends at Liberties, a quarterly journal of culture and politics, for helping bring such great guests as Samir Lane. Going to run a short feature on Liberties, and then we'll be back with Samir to talk more about his career and what he looks for in America in the 2020s. So don't go away, anyone. We'll be back in a second.
The noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with Samir Lane, many, many things. Samir, so you come back from the Olympics. Much of your career since then, and as a post-athlete, I guess, has been in innovation. You roomed with Zuckerberg at Harvard. Have you always been an innovator? And does being an innovator, does that associate you think, with an America that many people define as, if there's anything that ties Americans together, it's that they're very good innovators?
Yeah. You know what? I think for me, I've always been, I'd call it an independent thinker, right? In addition to being an innovator. And so my ability to innovate has been around the path I've charted myself, but also thinking outside the box about experiences that I want to have and ways that I can leave a legacy and have an impact. And so for me, as you mentioned, that started with go to law school, go to Georgetown for law school. I passed the bar exam. I'm supposed to end up at a law firm. And instead, I take this detour for almost a decade to be a professional track and field athlete and a triple jumper. But that added another dimension to my background and myself, my career, that I think I wouldn't have had otherwise. But you know, yeah, even I was always a curious mind. And again, a lot of that came from my parents, making sure I always had a book in my hand, making sure I was always learning in the summers. And I'm always trying to figure new things out. In high school and growing up, we weren't allowed to watch TV during the week. The only show we were allowed to watch was Jeopardy. And so, you know, I was always had a curious mind, always had a book in my hand.
Whose decision was that, your mother or your father?
It was both of them. They did things in tandem, but
so
yeah,
they ran a tight ship. Do you do the same with your kids?
I'm not. I probably should be. My wife and I, we do run a tight ship, not as tight a ship, I'll say. And so my daughter, she's turns 4 next week. She knows how to use an iPad and a phone and all of that stuff, even though she doesn't have her own. But no, my parents, even on the weekend when we were allowed to watch TV, it was for, you know, you got 60 minutes a day or 120 minutes a day to watch whatever cartoons you want to watch, and that's it. But yeah, my ability to be an innovator really started just as a child, right? And being inquisitive and being curious and wanting to learn and do new things. And today it's manifested itself in the career that I've had, or careers, right? Because I've touched many different areas.
Yeah, you roomed with perhaps the best known of all American entrepreneurs. Do you think of yourself as an entrepreneur? If there's one word, I mean, we got a lot of words, Samir, mm-hmm. and I've taken these words from your website: athlete, entrepreneur, author, philanthropist, attorney, educator, investor. If you was to choose one of those words, would it be entrepreneur?
Yeah, it almost certainly would be, only because that encompasses almost all of those other things, right? And so now, having launched my own venture fund, yeah, I'm an investor, but being at the helm of the fund, you're also an entrepreneur because we're building it from the ground up. Even as an athlete, I was a lot of times, I had agents and managers and so on and so forth, but a lot of times I was was seeking out my own sponsorship deals, my own partnership deals, and I ended up being sponsored by Mizuno. I sought that deal myself, and I had other sponsors during my time. But even as an independent athlete, you are your own business, right? And so all of those other titles, I think entrepreneur encapsulates all of them, right? Even philanthropist, right? Because ended up doing my own nonprofit for a time, and then hopped on the board of others. But a lot of what I've been able to do, I think it would be encapsulated by the phrase entrepreneur, by the term entrepreneur, for sure.
We've mentioned Zuckerberg a few times, certainly one of the great celebrities of our age. You've also worked with a lot of other celebrities, including Jay-Z. What do you make, Sameer? You grew up in obscurity in upstate New York. You work very hard. What do you make of our celebrity culture? A lot of people find it rather distasteful. You're part of it, I guess, in a way. You're almost a celebrity yourself. Maybe not, you don't compete with Zuckerberg or Jay-Z, but you're a player. Do you find it attractive, or in some ways distasteful, or a little bit of both?
You know what? I think the celebrity culture itself, to me, isn't distasteful at all. I find that sometimes what can be distasteful is excess. Like, and so it's not just the fact that there are celebrities. Sometimes you get excess, right? And when that excess is juxtaposed with a lot of the class differences and the lack of, especially here, I'm in Southern California, Los Angeles, right, where homelessness is somewhat rampant. And so sometimes the excess can be distasteful, but celebrity culture itself, no. I think the other piece is what can be distasteful to me personally is sometimes there's celebrity culture that morphs into idolatry. And now you get some of these celebrities who are idolized in a way that, you know, they probably shouldn't be. And a lot of times they themselves would agree that they shouldn't be. But celebrity culture itself, no. And maybe it's because I'm biased and I've been in it to some extent, have been close enough to celebrities who very often are just normal people and want to be seen and dealt with as normal people. And so I understand that celebrity culture itself isn't distasteful or isn't an innately negative thing. But I think especially because sometimes those celebrities end up being heroes, right? There's the negative side for me, which is idolatry, but the other side, which is you get the heroism, and sometimes those celebrities, whether athletes or even musicians and actors, can end up being heroes for people who need heroes and who need role models to some extent. And so there are absolutely positive aspects to it.
I'm guessing if there'd have been a Facebook when you were growing up, or an Instagram or a TikTok, your parents wouldn't have allowed you to use it. There's a huge raging debate now. Again, Sameer, you don't need me to tell you this, about social media and kids in the US. There are some people who believe that it should be outlawed or restricted. What's your take? Do you let your kids use social media? And do you think that it's problematic in terms of compounding anxiety and loneliness and many of the other problems associated with being young in America today?
Yeah. Well, I'll give the caveat that it's not something that I've researched, right? So I think that there's a ton of research on both sides that statistically says one thing or another. I think my personal opinion is, I don't let my kids use it at the moment because my oldest child is only turning 4. And my wife and I don't think we ultimately will let her use social media for a while. But at the same time, I don't think that it in and of itself has the ability to create all of these negative impacts on children, right? And so I think that at the end of the day, it's like any form of entertainment. It's probably part of the reason that my parents, as we were growing up, didn't allow us to watch a ton of television, or when we did, they were always monitoring what we were watching, right? So anything you consume entertainment wise, it can be social media, it can be movies, it can be video games, music, all of those things. Anything you consume without the ability to moderate consumption, depending on what it is that you're consuming, or the ability to counteract that consumption, right? Like, and so for me, I believe whatever we were watching, my parents were there to counteract, to either teach lessons or let us know that, you know, this is why you shouldn't do X, Y, and Z, and to learn from it. And I feel like social media is the same way, right? So if you leave kids to their own devices and it's all they consume, and they're following the wrong channels, right? And so to some extent, I understand that it's nearly impossible to 100% moderate what you're what you're consuming on social media. But if you were on social media and you only followed news outlets and so on, yeah, you'd probably still get access to some of those more negative influences in terms of profiles. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's just solely being on social media or solely having a profile or scrolling or anything like that. And I do think, you know, even still, I think there's a job to be done outside of handing your child a phone and letting them be to their own devices, right? And so if you do that, whether it's social media or it's any other form of entertainment, which to me, that's what social media is, I think you get in trouble. But I also do think that social media itself allows you to stay connected and allows you to stay informed. And so, you know, it's not innately a negative thing, but it does, you do have to, as a parent, right? You do have to moderate what accounts your child is following and what they're doing and so on and so forth. And I know that Meta and the social media and every other social media platform has started to put, or has already.
Have you talked to your old friend? I know you said when you come down to the Bay Area, you get together with Zuckerberg. Yep. Have you talked to him about this?
No, I haven't. I mean, when we catch up, it's more as old friends catching up than a conversation about the platforms and the businesses and all that stuff as well.
We are in America of the 2024, Samir. We've done a number of shows on all the problems. You don't strike me necessarily as someone who's profoundly political, but a lot of concern in this country now about a possible civil war. As a new movie out on imagining American civil war, we've done many shows on it. What's your take on the America of the 2020s, particularly in 2024? Is it a country on the verge of a nervous breakdown, on the verge of civil war?
No, I'm not profoundly political. Civil war, I would say that the divisions in the country are whether it's class or race or any of the divisions that exist, are evident. They're becoming more and more evident. A lot of what's becoming more evident for me is like division in class, right? And so that gap is getting wider and wider. I'm not sure if it's on the brink of civil war, but I would say that America today is as divided as it was previously. And that division may just be a different sort of division. In some cases, that division, it may just be, it's under the surface as opposed to being like truly, truly explicit, but it's still a divided country, right? And so you've got class divides, you do have race divides, and that class divide seems to be getting wider, but you know, it's something that I can only comment on anecdotally, having just lived in the world and seen what I've seen.
You're a philanthropist, which means you're committed to giving to the public good. What should innovators be working on in the America of 2024? What do you like, or what do you generally give your money towards in terms of not just economic investment and making money, but philanthropy towards the public good? Where do you see, where do you prioritize your philanthropy?
Yeah, so two things. In Haiti, and so giving time and effort and energy and money to children in Haiti in particular. And then here in the States, also giving a lot of time to kids and especially kids that have athletic programs or athletic desires. And then the other piece is, you know, your question on what should innovators be thinking about and where should it be give, especially those who want to give back in any way. For me, it's the wealth gap is a big piece, right? And so that wealth gap, which is also, I think the gap in wealth is also drawn among racial lines, right? So you've got the wealth gap between black and brown Americans and white Americans is wide and widening and won't be closed for many, many decades and without a very, very concerted effort. And so, you know, it's probably a three-part answer to your question. A lot of my time and effort goes to Haiti and children in Haiti. A lot of it goes to a lot of volunteering and sports volunteering I do here in the U.S. working with kids. And then the third piece, and the piece that I think innovators should be looking at, particularly those who have the ability to make a difference, is the divide in access and wealth amongst the country itself, right? Because I think that class divide is only widening. And I also think that the racial wealth, we talked about just previously, right? The history of Haiti versus the history of US, the racial wealth divide, a lot of that comes from the US's history and some of the systems that were in place then, to disenfranchise Black Americans that are still in place now and just have morphed and maybe aren't as evident to some people, but still exist in different forms. And so closing that racial wealth divide is a big deal for me as well.
We have lots of people on the show, as you can imagine, Sammy, trying to imagine how to innovate. And there seems to be, when it comes to the addressing the issues you talk about, the divide and inequality, maybe three areas where people focus on. The first is regulation, the role of the government and state, new laws, new restrictions. The second is new technology, particularly AI, but other technologies as well, coming out of Silicon Valley in particular. And the third is local political action. Where do you come down on in terms of innovation between those three and where you put your money and your time?
Yeah, I think that they're all three of those are necessary if you're going to address some of the issue that we're talking about, that racial wealth divide or any issue for that matter. I think you do need to have all three of those, check all three of those boxes. For me, it's on the innovation / technology side. Especially when you're talking about, as an investor, as someone who's launched their own venture fund, looking at empowering entrepreneurs of all backgrounds, right? Because I think a lot of wealth creation in the U.S. comes from business and technology and entrepreneurship. And a lot of times what we found is that venture dollars in particular, 98% of venture dollars are going to white entrepreneurs. And then the same can be said when you're looking at the gender divide as well, right? And so female entrepreneurs also just get a fraction of any venture dollars. And so investing in technology, investing in entrepreneurs and founders and people who are looking to generate wealth. A lot of the wealth creation in the United States comes from entrepreneurship, as we said, and it comes from being a business owner. It doesn't mean that you're a founder of Facebook or Meta or whatever that is. Like, just being a business owner and just a small business owner can help create wealth for a family and for generations to come. But for me, you know, a lot of that is to your point, those three pillars of how you can make a difference and hopefully close addressing some of that wealth gap, technology, entrepreneurship, investing in diverse founders, and also even for us as a fund, having diverse investors in the fund as well, right? Because the other, it's a two-headed monster where a lot of times venture dollars don't go to Black or brown or female entrepreneurs, but also you're not getting a lot of Black, brown or female entrepreneurs who are investors into funds, or who are investors themselves. And I think you've got to attack it from all those angles that you mentioned, though, Andrew. It's the local, it's the federal regulatory, and then it's also on the technology / on a personal level as well.
One of the biggest problems in America, Samir, and America has, as you know, many, many problems, seems to be immigration, both legal and illegal. What's your take on it in terms of innovative solutions, innovative fixes, which will satisfy maybe not everyone, but most Americans?
Yeah. Well, you know, as the child.
And I'm asking you, obviously, as a legal, you're not an immigrant, but your parents were.
As a child of immigrant, I wish I could say it's something that I've thought through more. But not just thought through. I've thought through, but thought through innovative solutions to address the, because you do have this divide amongst people who are for immigration and for open immigration and people who aren't. And so, no, I haven't yet found what that innovative solution could be. Clearly, I'm a proponent of immigration itself and understand that, again, just like with affirmative action, I think that there are some misconceptions around the idea that it's solely illegal immigrants coming and taking American jobs versus the value that immigrants have created for the U.S. as a whole, historically and even now, right? And so my wife and I, who, you know, she's from Trinidad and Tobago, but we always joke about One of the forefathers of Chicago is of Haitian descent. And if you go to Charleston, South Carolina, you'll see statues of Haitian soldiers who fought in the Civil War. And that's just clearly it's pertinent to me as a Haitian American. But in general, I think without immigration adding, without immigrants coming to U.S. and just adding innumerable value to what has taken place for the U.S. as a country throughout history and some of the developments we've made and so on and so forth, I think this is a very different place. The solution, though, to address the problem that I think divides a lot of people, I wish I had it. I wish I had it. But no, it's, you know, like I said, clearly I'm a proponent of immigration and also this being a place where people can come and seek opportunities and seek whatever their version of the American dream is. But it is something that, you know, you do have to find a way to address it such that it no longer divides people as much as it does now.
Couple of final questions, Samir. In 2026, America will be celebrating, if that's the right word, its 250th anniversary. Will you be celebrating? What do you think you'll be doing? And what should we be celebrating? Because it's been any country that gets to be 250 years old is an achievement. But in American terms, it's a remarkable achievement, both in itself and also in its impact on the world globally.
Great question. I don't know if I'll be celebrating. I think, and I don't know if it's a time to celebrate versus a time to be introspective. And that's in terms of people not just celebrating the fact that the country is 250 years old, which is an accomplishment. But I think beyond that, I think you also just want to take that time to think about what the country looks like at 250 years, what the country was founded on, right? And people always forget the country at that time was founded on the notion that Black people were fighting for freedom, fighting for equal rights, and then were worth 3/5 of a man, right? And so now you kind of want to be introspective in terms of how far we've advanced, if we've advanced, how far we still have yet to go in a number of different areas. And that's, of course, when you're talking about racial diversity and equality, but also gender and so on and so forth. I'm not one to say like America's 250 years old, VP.
No barbecue in the backyard, hamburgers, sparing.
We'll probably just because it's a national holiday, we'll probably barbecue. But I think for myself and for other people, I think it should be more of a time to just think through. The country's come a long way, but has so much further to go. Where can it improve, right? And where should it improve? And especially in that time, and as I mentioned, there are divides that are starting to that are only widening, that are only getting more obvious. And 2 years from now, I'm sure those divides will still be prevalent, right? And so at that point in time, you want to ask what has been done, what could be done, what should be done, who in this country needs help, how do you help them, how do you address some of this division that is, because again, 2 years from now, I think some of the divisions that exist today will be even more prevalent at that point in time, unfortunately. And so the question will be, shouldn't just be a celebration. It really should just be a question of what are we do? What is America? What does it mean for us to be American? And what does this country want to be known for? And how do we, if at all, get back to where we should be as a nation?
Well, let's end on a really long term question. Keynes, the economist, suggested in the long term we're all dead. Hopefully in 2076, you won't be dead, but you'll be quite a lot older. Your kids will be in their 50s. What can America excel at between 2020? It can't do much between now and 2026.
Yeah.
But what can America excel at between 2026 and 2076? Should it, for example, innovate when it comes to addressing the climate crisis or social and economic inequality or the role of AI? What would you like America to be remembered for as a 21st century power, both domestically and globally?
Yeah, I'd love for again, not to not to skirt your question, but two things, right? I'd love for at that time, racial and social equality and justice. I'd love for us to be more out front in how we address it in our own country, because a lot of times we'll go elsewhere to jump into other issues. But I'd love for us to think innovatively, and whether that incorporates how AI plays a role in hopefully not solving, but at least lessening the social and racial inequality, because I don't think it's, I personally don't think it's something that can be solved. I think, sad to say, to some extent, it's in the fabric of what this nation was founded on. But, you know, another 50 years from now, or 52 years from now, I hope that the U.S. can be known for addressing, or at least making a valiant attempt to address its inequalities. And then the second piece is being at the forefront of artificial intelligence innovation. And maybe the two of those go hand in hand, right? Maybe the U.S. being at the forefront of AI innovation means that AI plays a role in how you address racial and social inequality. I don't know what role that is, but it would be a great one to see. Maybe it's AI plays a role in addressing implicit bias, which hopefully has a knock-on effect on addressing racial and social inequality. But those are the two things that in 50 years, it'd be great for the U.S. to take a look at itself figuratively, and then do a better job at addressing some of those inequalities, particularly racial and social.